Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hey, Mets fans, welcome back to Today Your Love, Tomorrow the World Series. I'm Brian, he's Chris. And Chris, we have been going through quite the journey with the 2024 Mets. Our first podcast after games started was a collective sigh and frustration. Our second podcast after games started was a, hey, things are looking up. This, now our third podcast recorded after games have started, seems like everything is going right for the Mets right now. It's a lot of fun to watch Mets baseball right this second. And so for the start of our show, it's our time for our vibe check. How are you feeling about the New York Mets as of Thursday, April 18th, 2024?
Hell of a lot better than 1 or 2 weeks ago. this is good. This is the ideal scenario that we had hoped to, we'd see late in spring training. The ironic thing is that the Mets have completely turned their season around without JD Martinez even playing baseball yet, never mind joining the major league team. So yeah, it's pretty great. I had listened to the series finale against the Pirates, and I say listen because even when I had SNY on, I was not really looking at the screen, but I was listening to Gary, Keith, and Ron, and then alternated between that broadcast and the radio one. So I don't know who to credit here. I think it was Gary. It might have been Howie. But somebody was talking about the fact that the Mets had turned their season to start 0-5 and be over 500 just 17 games into that season. It's only been done, I think this was the fifth time a team had ever done that in the history of baseball.
Wow.
So, it stood out, right? I mean, it when you start that poorly, I thought we'd be looking at, could they get just to 500 by the end of April, middle of May? And obviously they've drastically turned things around. So yeah, feeling pretty good. Also not prematurely celebrating. A friend of mine sent me a tweet by a regular contributor to another website that writes about the Mets, where that contributor was essentially victory lapping. See, I told you the team is good and they've been over 500 for 2 days. So let's
pump the brakes on that a little bit. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. But going into the Atlanta series, the fact that it was four games, it wound up being three because of rain. And then two, just historically what tends to happen to the Mets when they play in Atlanta. It was a very realistic and reasonable concern that we had that if it's one of those series in Atlanta, the season could be down the drain before we get to the middle of April. And to their credit, they didn't let that happen. They not only did they win two or three, but they were right in it in the game that they lost. They didn't look overmatched. So feels pretty good. Feels like this is a team that, I don't know how much of a chip they have on their shoulder, because to some extent, I think a lot of the players at least are isolated from the just absolute wild things that exist, whether it's on WFAN or Mets Twitter or wherever else. But yeah, it feels good that the Mets might be competitive and relevant, and there's a long way to go. But better to be feeling this way than the way we felt even when they won that one game in the first homestand, the second game of the doubleheader, the last game of the homestand. Mm-hmm. It didn't feel that good. It felt better than if they were 0-6, but it didn't feel like, yay, you know?
Right. The overall feeling I had was like, fucking finally, right? Like it was more exacerbation at it took this long to get to a win versus like, woohoo, a win.
Right.
Yeah. And, you know, I am in the middle of writing a series preview for Amazing Avenue for the Dodger series. And, you know, the last time the Mets lost two games in a row was before they won their first game. So they have just been rolling ever since then. They've won every series since those first two. They haven't lost back-to-back games. The bullpen has been phenomenal. I mean, really, like, unbelievably good. You know, we had talked about the Michael Tonkin of it all initially when we were talking about the bullpen. And, you know, he's back. We should mention that. He was claimed off waivers from the Twins. And they unfortunately had to DFA Tyler J, who was the feel-good story of last week. I'm sure he'll figure something out, whether it's within the organization or elsewhere. But I'd like to see him stick around. He looked reasonably good in his Mets appearances. But, you know, the bullpen's been very, very good. Reed Garrett, who my primary Reed Garrett memory from before his call-up was you and I trying to figure out how many double T players played for the Mets past. Just some Slack messages back and forth from you saying like, how many players do you think with double T's in their names have played for the Mets, and just us discussing this. So, you know, everything is just kind of working right now. You know, the worst start they've had by a starter in this stretch, they had that that Adrian Hauser start from last week that wasn't fantastic but was okay, and then they had Sean Manaea kind of blew up on Saturday in his start. But for the most part, the starters have been good. People are hitting up and down the lineup, man. It just feels like a totally different team than the team we were watching a couple weeks ago. And that's a beautiful thing.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. The bullpen right now has, it's kind of a just weird set of circumstances. They're seventh in baseball in ERA, but first in the National League. Reason the American League bullpens are just unreal to start the year. But bullpen's got a sub-3 ERA, best mark in the National League, best FIP of a bullpen collectively in all of baseball. And as a result, it's just, I know generally the preference is BWAR for pitchers, but it's so much easier to look at who's leading things on FanGraphs. So for what it's worth, FWAR, the Mets bullpen is number one in baseball, which is essentially derived from being the best team in terms of FIP. It's a treat to watch. And I forget whether or not I said it on the podcast. I know I've definitely said it to you and other people online or offline, but it's a half joke. But if this Mets team turns out to be really good, and it was really good in 2022, and it was missing Edwin Diaz in 2023 and bad, I kind of think he should get some MVP votes because apparently he matters a lot. And of course there's more to it than that, but there is a little bit of seriousness in that sort of idea for me, that having somebody like that just completely changes what the other relievers feel like they need to do.
Right.
I'm sure a couple of relievers are going to struggle at some point, but right now it's like Jake Diekman has been the worst. I mean, Tonkin, I guess, has been the worst now that he's been
back to the roster.
To echo a point that we made after they DFA'd him and traded him to Minnesota for a week and a half, don't use him in extra innings.
Right.
He is essentially a middle innings eater. That was his thing he did for the Braves. I think he threw two innings or more last year in Atlanta more often than he threw fewer than two innings.
Yeah.
So this is a guy who, I think if there's a lead or a deficit of three or more runs in the fifth, sixth innings, and your starter's pitch count has gone up, he can go out there and not totally derail the game. And I'm trying to think, did we even see him? Let me check this real quick. But I feel like we didn't even see him come into a situation where there weren't runners on in his very brief
with the Mets. He pitched an inning or two on opening day. I think he might have come in on a clean inning on opening day.
Yeah, you're right.
The reason I know that is I wrote both his DFA and his trade article, so I had to. Yeah. I'm pretty well versed in his short Mets career so far.
Yes, yeah. So there you go. But in that case, he came in eighth inning, down two, and had a perfectly decent outing. And then the two train wreck outings were both in extra innings. So,
right.
Just don't do that to him again. And obviously, if it gets to a point that you've gone through every reliever and you get a rare 13 or 14 inning game, practically unheard of anymore. Sure. In that situation, you just have to go with somebody who's got an arm, who's there.
Right.
But.
Well, he also isn't much of a strikeout pitcher. And with the stupid fucking man on second base, you need someone who's going to get strikeouts. So right. he was a bad choice no matter how you – in every scenario, bringing him into those extra inning games was a bad idea.
Yeah.
So it's just silly.
Yeah. But, yeah, there's definitely an argument, and we haven't really seen the – and it's ironic because Buck Showalter is significantly older. But we haven't seen too much of the Edwin Diaz unconventional use. The eighth inning, you know, their best hitters are coming up, high leverage, use them there, or 10th inning or beyond, because his strikeout rate is so good and because he might be able to get you through that ridiculous rule with one run or no runs allowed. So I would love to see the Mets have the willingness to be that sort of creative that. And it doesn't have to be Tonkin, but let's say it's, I don't know, the 6-7-8, 7-8-9, even 8-9-1 hitters coming up for the opposing team in the ninth inning, especially if you're at home. Game's tied. It's not their best hitters. You know what? I'll give Tonkin or somebody else who's in that lower part of the bullpen, give them the ninth. They allow a run or two, whatever your team was going to have to score if you go to extras anyway.
Right.
And use Diaz in the 10th or the 11th. And worst case scenario there is that, all right, you lost the close game, didn't get to extras, but now you've got Diaz available the next day because he didn't pitch. And I don't know.
No, I agree. I wonder if we'll see that a little bit more down the road for Mendoza. You know, I think there is a feeling among new managers that you kind of have to play things by the book to start because you have to show the people who hired you that you're a competent person and aren't going to be making wild decisions. Even though I don't think bringing Diaz in the seventh when it's clearly the make or break point in the game, I don't think that's a crazy decision. I think most baseball fans with any either understanding of history and knowing how relief pitchers used to work or with any understanding of sabermetric principles would feel like that is the right time to bring in Diaz or save him for the 10th. You know, the scenarios you mentioned, I don't think that we're talking like crazy stuff here. I just think that for the average Mets fan that reads the paper, reads the New York Post and calls in WFAN, and those voices are the loudest voices when a new manager makes a mistake, they're sort of protecting against that as opposed to necessarily doing what's maybe the best move. And, you know, I don't think you should be making your decisions based on fear when you're a major league manager, but, you know, here we are. But yeah, so we briefly talked on how good Reed Garrett has been, but I want to talk more about Reed Garrett Before we started recording, Chris, you mentioned what his strikeout rate is currently. What is his current strikeout rate?
Oh, it's over 50%. Hold on. Let's see. I can be a little more specific than that, but I know it was over 50% as of the end of his most recent appearance. It is 54.8%.
Yeah.
That in the per nine version of that, it's 17.65 strikeouts per nine.
Yes. And just in comparison, he has struck out 17 batters in 8 2/3 innings. Four hits and three walks in that time as well. So his strikeout to walk ratio is 5.67. He's just having an insane stretch here. Do we think he's the second coming of Edwin Diaz? Well, I don't, but it's nice to see somebody emerge as a quality arm in that bullpen. Do you have any specific thoughts on maybe why he's being so successful or just enjoying the success as you're seeing it?
Yeah, not really any specific thoughts. He's a nice little microcosm, that's redundant, of the of the Mets season, because there was a moment early, I think it was while they were losing all five of their first games, and I forget if it was the second game of the doubleheader and it actually worked out in their favor, or one of the games that the weekend that followed. But I said to at least one fellow Mets fan, if Reed Garrett gets into this game, all is lost, right? what a disaster that would be. And that appearance and every appearance since have gone really, really well. I'm just looking real quick at his pitch usage on Brooks Baseball to see if I see anything noticeable. I mean, last year he wasn't throwing a curve much. He ditched it entirely. But the big swap is that he's barely throwing his fastball and he's throwing his slider almost the majority of the time. So I don't know if that's a Mets pitching lab development, considering he's been in the Mets organization. We, I guess, should have every reason to think that it is. But yeah, the slider usage is way up and he's got a splitter, and that's also up. So his top two pitches are slider splitter, whereas pretty much, and it's all limited data because he doesn't have that many major league innings, on his record. But his four seam fastball was his go-to pitch pretty much every year he was in the majors until this year. So maybe that's it. Maybe it's just something clicked. That pitch is that good. And it would be really nice to see the Mets turn a long time sort of mediocre results type guy into an elite reliever. Like, there's no reason that the Tampa Bay Rays should be the only team that does that.
Agreed. Yeah.
So I don't know if this means the Mets figured that out and they're going to be the team that does that all the time. Tampa's been doing it for what, 20 years? But it would be nice if this was an example of it. I expect he'll finish the season with an ERA higher than zero. But
right. But I think it was Gary on the broadcast this week had talked about how Garrett was basically throwing breaking pitches ahead in the count. And the bullpen in general has been doing this, but specifically Garrett doing that, where, the traditional sort of frame of reference here is that you, or the traditional, there's a phrase in my head I cannot get out. The traditional way you go about things, that's the ineloquent way of saying it, is that you use your fastball to establish and then you use your breaking pitch as an out pitch. But they were saying that Garrett is now using his breaking stuff just anywhere in the count, it's working for him, and that's great. Now, it shouldn't have taken this many years for him to realize that, possibly, but you never know how these people are being coached. You never know what they're hearing. And if that's what it took for this change to happen, that's great. The bullpen has been really impressive in general. Garrett's a really nice example of that. But it's funny because I think a lot of us expected the Michael Tonkins and Jake Diekmans of the world to be the breakout stars of the bullpen, because that's sort of the bullpen that David Stearns has put together a lot, many times in his career so far. In Milwaukee, his bullpen was always made up of guys that were no names that would eventually come around and be impressive for a year or two. And so you're not expecting a guy who was already in the Mets system to be the breakout star of the bullpen, but that's obviously what's happening so far with Reed Garrett.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
The other player that I think you and I both owe a bit of a mea culpa to is Harrison Bader. We were both pretty harsh on him in this podcast. And I will still say, I don't think Harrison Bader is really good. I think he's probably playing well above his average talent level right now. But thus far, Harrison Bader, I mean, this past week, he has been an offensive powerhouse for the Mets, hitting a home run, driving in some RBIs late in games, just really a very effective player, and has looked pretty good in center field too. So I answered this to you, Chris, in a DM on Slack, but I said that they should trade Harrison Bader because his value will never be higher. And I kind of believe that, but if he has another week like this one, I may hold on to him for a little bit longer. Any big Bader thoughts?
Another player who's gone from, I don't know, being a concern of mine to winning me over. It was nice to see him make a play that seemed legitimately spectacular in center field. That catch he made against the Pirates, it actually reminded me of a catch that, fittingly, Andrew McCutchen made against the Mets at Citi Field. And this is going way back. Maybe either the first year the park was open or 2010-11, somewhere in that range. But same kind of fly ball, right center field gap. Obviously, the fences were even deeper at the time. But McCutchen at the time was playing center field. He has to break back into his left and just run down a fly ball and make that same sliding catch, which is a really good, like, fundamentally sound way to do that. And also slightly safer for, like, your head and neck than trying to make a head first catch as you're approaching the wall. So Bader's catch was maybe like 90% as good as the one I remember McCutchen making at that time. But I needed something to go, all right, not everybody can do that, because it's tough. And I mean, I used to always say that you couldn't really fully appreciate Carlos Beltran's defense in center unless you went and sat in the upper deck behind home plate a lot at Shea and a little bit at Citi Field, obviously. So maybe Bader is kind of doing what Beltran used to do. Although the early season metrics, and I don't want to read too much into them, because I'm sure defense is extremely prone to small sample size stuff, but StatCast stuff, right? Mm-hmm. Bader was not standing out in outs above average or anything. So he wasn't hitting at all. And if he was doing the Beltran thing and making center field look easy, even though it wasn't, it's harder to pick up on that on TV. And there had been a couple borderline plays where he like got his glove to the ball but didn't catch it. And you and I are in Slack back and forth with just like, man, how much more do we have to watch of this guy? Ironically, or you know what? Maybe it's not ironic. Maybe DJ Stewart and Harrison Bader started to play a little bit better when JD Martinez had his setback and Gilbert hit the injured list, because those are two guys who, in my opinion, if they were both getting regular reps in Syracuse and tearing the cover off the ball, how long do you go before you start to question? I mean, even now, when JD Martinez is ready, he is going to take the job from Stewart.
Yes.
That, like, that, that's happening. But I'm sure if you're Bader, you got your contract, but you want to play. You don't want to just be a bench guy. I have no idea if he actually felt any pressure from the likes of Gilbert getting off to a hot start and sort of displacing him in the outfield, but whether or not that was the case, the timing works out, and it's nice that guys who are on the major league roster right now have stepped up a bit when their most natural replacements are hurt,
right,
in the minors. So yeah, glad to see it. More of those spectacular defensive plays, please, because I don't know how long he'll hit 300 or better, even if it's not with a ton of power, although there was a little bit of power recently.
There was,
but he had himself a week that I at least could go, okay, this is why Cardinals and Yankees fans liked him.
Right.
Because for the first, it wasn't just the 0-5 stretch. Like, maybe the first 10 games of the Mets season, I was like, what? I don't get it. Like, what was it that made people like him? But hey, the more Mets that I feel that way about that win me over this year, the better things have been going.
Absolutely. And I do think that the Bader has a useful spot on this roster, even if Gilbert comes up. I think, you know, depending who is playing the outfield when alongside Gilbert when he comes up, you know, you may want to pull one of those guys for defense if it's a late and close game and you want to have somebody who really can flash leather out there. You know, there's value in that. There's value in having a defensive center fielder on your roster for extreme fly ball pitchers that are starting, right? There's lots of reasons to have Harrison Bader on your roster. I think that there are few reasons to have Harrison Bader starting once Drew Gilbert is up, or at least starting with any regularity.
Right. So,
you know, we'll see how that develops over time. But speaking of the minor leagues, Chris, you went to a game this week. Who'd you see play?
Sure, yeah. Caught a Rumble Ponies game. Happened to catch a very good one. And I'll actually start with maybe my only negative note from the night. Only because center fielders and defense are on the mind. To me, Alex Ramirez, not a center fielder. He's gotten off to a great start with the bat. That's super encouraging. He had a down year last year. If he keeps hitting like that and needs to move to a corner, that is not the end of the world. Also, been to a couple of Rumble Ponies games this year, and he is listed as 6'3". I am 6'2". He is not 6'3". He's got to be 6'6", 7", something like that. Either that or he's just so tall and skinny that he looks like he's towering over me.
Wow.
But he is a tall, lanky guy. His roots in center field the other night were not inspiring. And I actually would argue that the main player to talk about from that game, Blade Tidwell, one of his runs that he allowed was essentially completely the result of Ramirez taking bad roots to two fly balls. So there was no error to make it an unearned run, but essentially a ball that fell in like, I wouldn't even say shallow, like shallow to medium left center field. Ramirez just didn't get to and probably should have. So that falls in for a single. Next batter hits one much better struck ball into the right center field gap. The right fielder, it's escaping me who was playing right field at the moment. Right fielder comes over. Diving, attempted catching, hits his glove, but he just can't hold on to it. But again, a ball that maybe an average or better defensive center fielder would be catching, maybe even camped under. Anyway, sorry, Alex Ramirez. Maybe that defensive side of his game will improve, and maybe he'll show that he is a center fielder. But Tidwell really was the star of that night. The Rumble Ponies tied a franchise record going back to a game in 1995. that Jason Isringhausen pitched in. So the Binghamton pitchers struck out 18 batters the other night, which tied the franchise record for strikeouts in a game. Tidwell had 10 of those strikeouts, and man, he looked good.
How many innings did Tidwell pitch?
Five. So
10 strikeouts in 5 innings. Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, he didn't even throw that many pitches. I think you're looking at, just sort of managing workloads and that sort of thing. He also had been bumped to pitching the middle innings, because Max Kranick was on a rehab assignment. He threw 2 2/3. He looked great too, by the way. I know it's just double A, and for a guy who's got some major league experience, maybe we don't want to be too impressed by it, but Kranick had his own good outing. I think he had 5 of the strikeouts. Tidwell had 10. And then the two other pitchers who got in the game had 1 or 2 each. Oh, no, actually, no, sorry. Kranick had 6. and then he got to sort of his pitch count that they had set for him in that rehab start. Brought in a reliever, Trey McLaughlin. So, yeah. It was just strikeouts galore.
Yeah.
But yeah, the big takeaways for me, Tidwell, I didn't get to too many games last year. So I saw Tyler Stewart pitch last year and maybe not like his most impressive start. I did not catch Christian Scott last year. I would love to see him in person this year, but honestly, the way he's pitching, that might happen in Queens before,
right.
Before Syracuse. But yeah, Tidwell is a guy who came in, I think, on the Amazing Avenue top 25 Mets prospects for this year. He came in at 11th. So slightly behind the likes of Vassell, Hamill, certainly all those guys are behind Scott in those rankings. Those rankings from this winter. And if those were to be redone now, Scott might even overtake, some of the position players as maybe the best prospect in the Mets system. But all of that is to say, Tidwell, I know I caught him on one of his best nights as a pro, but I loved what I saw. One of his walks was a pitch clock violation walk, which, look, that's a thing that can happen. So I can't completely let him off the hook for the 3 balls that he threw before the pitch clock violation, but it's still different to me in judging somebody.
Absolutely.
Than actually throwing ball 4. So one of the runs shouldn't have been earned. One of the walks was a pitch clock walk. And even then, you're still looking at a great line. 5 innings, 10 strikeouts, 3 walks, 2 runs allowed. He threw 88 pitches. So I was, close to blown away. He went after guys. The fastball was good, sat mid 90s, and then touched 96, 97, according to the, what was up on the scoreboard. I'd assume at this point with the technology in these ballparks that that's pretty accurate. But and the curve looked, when it worked, the curve looked great. I mean, he absolutely froze a couple guys. With a curveball that just had a nice bite to it at the end. Obviously, with Doc Gooden's number being retired, there was a lot of talk recently about his curveball and how rare that type of curveball is in the game today. It doesn't look like that, but it was a nice it was just a nice breaking ball that was capable of either fooling guys into being frozen or getting some swings and misses. And when it didn't work, it was generally just kind of, it was ended up high and away, like other batter's box high and away to a right-handed hitter.
So it wasn't falling into the power zone for a batter.
No. Yeah. If you're going to miss with it, I'd much rather see it just kind of float up there and be a ball than float over the middle of the plate and not break and just be a home run instead. So,
right.
Yeah. Yeah. Really liked what I saw. Obviously he's got to repeat that, but as guys get their shot from Syracuse to get up and join the major league team, whether it's through performance or injuries or whatever, I don't know, a month or two where he is pitching like that, I could see him getting to Syracuse this year, which is not too shabby. He's still only 22.
Right.
So yeah, good to see. And then the other note was that I felt like I at least got to know who Max Kranich was as a pitcher. I can't give you quite as detailed a breakdown of what I thought of his stuff, but the results were there. He worked efficiently. His pitch count was not very high. They're clearly working him back pretty slowly on this rehab assignment, because at the moment there's not a spot for him. Certainly not in the rotation at the major league level. But it was nice to see two pitchers who I could say, okay, there was something there, that if Kranich gets some starts this year, or if they have a sort of long relief role maybe in mind for him, if he gets fully healthy and he's pitching well, he's got options, so he could just end up in Syracuse. But it was nice. He was a guy that I had to look up, like when he got hurt in spring training, I didn't even realize he was on the roster. So
right.
Those are my takeaways. And Jet Williams smoked the ball twice. Once was right at the right fielder. The other time was a single. Good to see. He's gotten off to a slow start. Really, Ramirez, of the prospects who are hitters, is maybe the only one who's gotten off to like a rip-roaring start. But Jet will get there. So, yeah, not to step too much on the toes of our minor league colleagues, but some firsthand accounts of what I saw in Binghamton this week.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, look, I think it's awesome that the Mets have players that weren't considered necessarily can't miss prospects that are now showing something. You know, Tidwell's name was always, you know, in the back of the list in terms of the exciting Mets prospects, but you know, if he can turn it into something, I mean, Christian Scott's name wasn't really all that well regarded until a year or so ago, right? Like we're seeing the Mets system start to turn out players that, I mean, Jose Budo, again, just, I know we are champions for him, and that we are the founding members of the Jose Budo Appreciation Society, but you know, even just Budo, that's a player that wasn't expected to be this good. And so if the Mets, you know, with a new and improved player development system being put in place by Stearns, when you have players that are coming out of your player development, coming out of your system, that are really being benefited by good process, I don't know, man, that's pretty exciting for me. I love seeing homegrown players take the step and become, you know, big league players and good big league players. And I will always be too optimistic about prospects, because that's what homers do for their teams, but also because of the Jacob deGroms of the world, people who weren't supposed to be superstars and wound up being absolutely superstars. So yeah, this is all very exciting. And when the Mets are winning in the major league level and their prospects are looking good down below, that's the best of both worlds for a Mets fan. So this is very fun right now. But on that note, Chris, what is your music pick for this week?
So I'm going to go with some relatively obscure psych rock from current times. Certainly fits in with a lot of the stuff that I listen to that's influenced by music from psych rock's original heyday. But it's a German artist who goes by CV, as in Victor, CV Vision. And I don't remember. I think I found his music on like a Reddit thread about recommendations for this general style of music. It's possible that it popped up in like a Spotify radio type thing, but I think I found it from an actual person who recommended it in a thread on Reddit. And the album is called Im Tal der Stützer. And I took a year of German in college. I hope my pronunciation was halfway decent there, but it's just, I love it. It's a fun record. And the second track, Die Frommen Wanderer, is one of the catchiest things I've heard in a long time. And over the last few weeks, I just kind of keep finding the riff from that stuck in my head. And then I go and listen to it to, to scratch that itch. But yeah, really good, pretty small artist, but would not be surprised if this is somebody who turned up at, assuming it actually happens this year or ever again, Desert Days or something along those lines. As far as I know, there haven't been any shows in New York City or anything, but I've kept my eye out. Would love to catch him live. And I think it's sort of like a Tame Impala situation where the one person plays all these different instruments and records all on their own. That's always cool when somebody can do that. So
absolutely.
Don't 100% quote me on that, but I think it's the case. and it's just a nice mix of all the best sort of elements of psych rock. And piggybacking a little bit on my Rusty Cage sort of note about, I don't know, the weather is getting better and things are warmer and happier and the Mets are playing better. Just that second track is really like a nice, hey, I want some music for a feel good situation. So yeah,
very nice.
There you go. Im Tal der Stützer by CV Vision.
Very nice. I'm glad you had to pronounce that and not me. I did not take a year of German, so I would not have done that very well. So last week I had recommended Magnetic Fields, 69 Love Songs. Went to go see two shows that they did in Town Hall. It was fantastic. One of the more prominent instruments on that record is the cello, and so that makes this week's pick make a little bit of sense. Arthur Russell was a cello player, a composer, a singer-songwriter who was from Iowa originally, moved to San Francisco to join a Buddhist commune in the early 70s before eventually settling in New York City. And when he settled in New York City, he got involved with the sort of downtown contemporary classical movement. He was a contemporary of Philip Glass's, for instance, but never really made music like that. He made all sorts of different kinds of music. He had a whole bunch of like early disco records under the name Dinosaur L, among others. And then later in his career, before his death, he was making sort of this arty pop music that had a lot of delay and echo on it. But the record I'm going to recommend is something I had never heard of until I watched a documentary about Russell, which is, I believe, until the end of the month on the Criterion channel. If anyone here is a Criterion subscriber, it's called Wild Combination, and it's a film about Arthur Russell. And he did a series of songs in the 70s called Instrumentals. And this is a funny title for him because he was working within the classical realm, but most classical music is instrumental. The term instrumental is what pop music calls itself when it doesn't have words in it. And so this is sort of the beginning of Russell moving from that sort of avant-garde classical thing into the pop world where he wanted to really live. These songs range in length from 30 seconds to just over 5 minutes long in this first volume. So it's called Instrumentals Volume 1, but you can't search for that. I'm making this difficult for everybody, but there's a record called First Thought, Best Thought that is a compilation of Arthur Russell's instrumental work. And that record is almost 3 hours long. I'm sorry, no, it's not. It's 2 hours and 7 minutes long. So over 2 hours long. Way too long for recommendation here because people may not want to sit through that. But if you just go to that record, First Thought, Best Thought, and the first 10 tracks are called Instrumentals Volume 1, and just listen to that, that's what my recommendation is this week. It's music that borrows a little bit from classical. It borrows a lot from pop and rock. It borrows a lot to my ears from soundtrack music, from films. But all these songs are really, really interesting. They are very melodic, very beautiful in times. Just a really interesting listen. And Arthur Russell's catalog is really interesting and weird. He's done like some almost country stuff, some pop stuff, some classical, some disco. So there's a lot to listen to there. And it can be overwhelming when an artist has that much diversity in their repertoire. So I am recommending just these 10 tracks. It should take you a little bit more than a half hour to listen to them. And so Instrumentals Volume 1, part of the First Thought, Best Thought compilation by Arthur Russell. That is my pick for this week.
Hey, artistic diversity within a catalog. If I haven't primed our audience for that, I don't know. I don't know what I'm even doing here. So,
I agree with that. And obviously, you and I have pretty Catholic lower C tastes when it comes to music. We listen to all sorts of stuff, but I recognize that not all of our listeners do that. And that's not a slant on them. I am very picky in certain parts of my life, but music is something I take in a lot of diversity from. So I think people would enjoy this. We'll see. Maybe not. And just for those keeping score at home, this is my fourth of last five or sixth of my last eight instrumental selections for this year. So apparently this is the year of Brian recommending instrumental music. But
nice.
Nothing wrong with that. Anyway, thank you for listening. As always, go to patreon.com/homeroundapplesauce for more. We'll have a new Patreon episode out next week. Chris and I are both on Instagram. He's at Chris McShane. I'm at Brian Needs a Nap. And until next time, let's go Mets.